I just saw him walk by. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jerome Lovato. I am currently serving as a role for the project manager for the Riesling Audit in Colorado. Today is February 17, 2017, 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time. We're going to do a roll call of those that are in the room, but first, those that are on the phone, if you could just identify yourself and your organization, that would be helpful to recognize who's talking. So those on the line, if you could just unmute your phone and identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Jerome. Janice, Boss Caudill, and Greg McPherson are here from Fishing County.
Good afternoon, Janice.
Philip Stark from UC Berkeley.
Philip Stark.
Chris Ford, Boulder County.
Pam Bacon, Logan County.
And Corrine Hennage from Arapahoe.
Trevor Timmons, Secretary of State's office.
Randy Wheeler from Washington County.
Sorry, will you say that again, please? The lady who just spoke.
This is Randy Ward from Washington County.
Rob Menzies, Dominion. Rob Menzies, Boulder County.
Ed Smith with Clear Ballot.
Okay, is that everybody online? So in the room here, in the Aspen Conference Room at the Secretary of State's office, we have Jesse Romero, Dwight Shellman, and Danny Casillas from the Secretary of State's office, and Ben Rector, who's also from our office. He's in our IT department. And then we have Harvey Branscombe, Neil McBurnett, Cody Swanson from Jefferson County, Merlin, is it Klotz?
Klotz and Kyle.
And Kyle from Douglas County, and Jimmy Flanagan and Steve from Denver County. So that's who we have here in our office. So what I'd like to do today is up on the screen, but also if you're not able to see the screen, on our Riesling Audit website, we posted all of the documents, so all of the written comments that were submitted from the last meeting. And what I did is I did a summary of those comments and try to highlight the kind of the main points. I didn't get into too much detail with this outline, but you can read all of the comments on our website. And so what I'd like to do today is go through this, first go through the summary, and then I'd like to stay in order of the summary as far as work to do here. So that way we can stay on track with one topic at a time and really get some good work from it versus trying to do everything at once. So for those who don't have it, you can find on our website that's titled like Summary of Written Comments. It's a PDF document. And so what we did is we broke down the summary into two main parts, the RLA concepts and RLA procedures, with the idea being that the concepts are just overall for the overall scope, but then also getting into the procedure, so the actual details of doing the work. So first we have define RLA, determine contest audit, determine risk limit, how to handle the various ballot issues, audit oversight, the county's role, the Secretary of State's role, RLA procedures, so what happens during pre-election, the steps to take during ballot scanning, and then the post-election part about it, of when will we do the audit, and the details that come with that. So I just want to start at item number one, defining a risk limiting audit. It seems like I think everybody has an idea of what it is that are participating in this group. But what I'd like to do is get input from the group to clearly define, or if there's a clearly defined definition of risk limiting audit, to be able to put it into layman's terms to be able to help digest this. So what I'd like to do is just open this up to the group and those that are in our office. We only have two microphones, so if you could just make sure that the light's blinking green when you speak and identify yourself and before you give your spoken comment. So does anybody have any ideas of where we should start here?
Well, this is Harvey.
This is Philip Stark. So it has a definition. It's an audit conducted in such a way that if a full manual count of the votes would show the outcome to be different, that is wrong, the audit has a large pre-specified chance of correcting the outcome. And the chance that the largest chance that the audit doesn't correct the outcome is the risk limit.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. Harvey, did you have...
Yes, Harvey. Just before we jump into this agenda, I just wanted to mention that I have uncovered this morning a paper called A Statistical Method for Auditing Vote Counting, which comes from written by Paul Walmsley and contributed to by Margaret Johansson, both here in Colorado. It's from 2005, and it quite closely describes what we're working on here. So I actually emailed it to you, Jerome, for everybody's distribution, just so it's possible to see. I think it's nice to have a shout out to Paul Walmsley for having predicted basically what we're doing here today. And I know it'll come as a little bit of a surprise to a lot of people because it's kind of buried in history already, but I have a copy here if anybody wants to look, but it's I sent a PDF to you, Jerome.
Yeah, I saw your email and just didn't get to read the document. Thank you, Harvey. Does anybody else have any input, feedback to what Philip Stark is defined as a risk-limiting audit?
This is Neil McBurnett, and I'll just say that it's I like the definition because it's both very general and very specific. So, you know, we know what the goal is, but we're given a lot of flexibility in how to get there. And people continue to come up with great ideas for how to make things more efficient and easier for the counties while still making sure that no matter what, I mean, software independence is a huge part of the background for all of this. And, you know, no matter what might happen with the software involved in the actual election, we'll end up with confidence that the paper ballots match the outcome.
Thank you, Neil. Anybody else before we move on to number two? Does anybody need, who's not familiar with risk limiting, does anybody need any additional detail about the definition? All right. Number two, determine the contest to audit. This seems to be one of the more challenging parts about it. Is do we as a state, are we going to just audit the federal and statewide races, and how deep are we going to go into auditing the county level races and even special districts and the smaller races? And so I'd like input from the group onto what you think is best for auditing, how far we should go, and really what contest we should be looking at for our audit.
So this is Neil McBurnett again. I think that it's useful to split the question into two different pieces. As soon as one of the things that our current vision of a risk-limiting audit entails is randomly selecting a cast vote record, then finding the ballot that matches that in the batches of ballots. And just retrieving that takes a little bit of time. And we're going to get good at that, but it still takes a little bit of time. Having gone to that effort, it seems to me that it would serve the public and serve all of us to look at the whole ballot. And actually, if we do that for just a small number of ballots, most of the contests in the election, of all the contests, and I know there can be hundreds of contests in a statewide, across the state, but if we just look at a small number of ballots, we'll get confidence for most of those very quickly. And at some point, then, if we continue to audit to the contests that are selected for determining what the risk limit is, we will only be looking at one or a couple of contests on the ballot. So I think we can have both the benefit of really auditing nearly everything to some level of confidence, just because we saw it on a ballot, and also be able to address the ones that we really care about. So I want to split it into two pieces, which is, should we go ahead and look to get confidence in all the contests once we've selected a ballot? And then a separate question of, how do we decide which contests we demand meeting the risk limit for? Because some contests are potentially difficult to meet the risk limit, and others, and they will drive kind of the overall audit.
This is Philip Stark again. I'd like to echo and elaborate and slightly contradict what Neil said. First of all, the way the audit will be conducted, I think it's probably better to select a ballot at random and find the CBR than to select the CBR at random and find the ballot, if only because we might not have a CBR for every ballot. That's one of the things that the audit should be checking for. I agree that if you're going to be pulling a piece of paper and looking at it, the incremental cost of looking at all the contests on the piece of paper rather than a few of them is in general not large compared to the cost of finding the piece of paper and pulling it out. That said, I think the decision of which contests to audit is really a political decision. It's not a statistical decision or an administrative decision. I don't know what the legislative intent was behind the drafters of the audit law. But every contest, can be wrong. If the contest has a large margin, the number of pieces of paper one needs to look at to confirm it is generally extremely small, assuming that the outcome is correct. If the margin is smaller, it takes more scrutiny. But, this really seems like a political decision, not an operational decision.
I would call it an operational decision. We typically have,
we identify ourselves.
Merlin Klotz, Douglas County. Our last election, we had 277 different styles, we had more than 50 different contests with overlapping boundaries. And so if you start with, and the original premise, as I understand risk-limiting audit, is to identify those with close margins and chasing them. Well, if I pull a ballot at random out of the stack, I'm not going to have all 277 different permutations. And so if you're going from a premise that if I test contest A and it's fine, I can assume that contest B is good, you've got a whole different scenario than if you are trying to test for the margins that are tight. We may have some permutations that have as few as 78 ballots in it, 78 different ballots on a style. And so it becomes an operational issue. It isn't like we're a precinct reporting process anymore. as a central scan operation, things change dramatically from a precinct level operation where every ballot in a precinct is identical. So I think we've got a whole different situation here than what was originally perceived on a risk-limiting audit.
Go ahead, Philip.
Sorry?
Go ahead. It sounds like there's some crosstalk there.
Somebody else.
You can't borrow strength from the results of one contest to get conclusions about the accuracy of the results of another contest. So the problem you pointed out, I mean, is correct, right? You can't, by looking at a ballot that doesn't contain some contest, make some conclusions about that contest. The risk-limiting audits don't just look at contests with small margins. The amount of scrutiny that they give depends on the margin. Contests with larger margins generally don't need to audit them to a given risk limit. Requires looking at fewer ballots than a contest with a smaller margin, again, on the assumption that the results are correct. I agree that the decision of which contest to audit has enormous implications for what happens operationally, but the decision of which contest to audit, seems to me like a political decision in that if the legislators say we are only going to audit the state level or county level contests, that's a political decision, even though I understand that the work that needs to be done is affected enormously, and that work happens at the local level. I don't think, depending on the particular technology that's being used to count the votes, we may be able to determine which collections of ballots have ballots of a particular style so that we can target the sampling related to a risk-limiting audit of a particular contest to only ballots that contain that contest. But that's going to vary by jurisdiction, depending on whether people are using the New Dominion system, depending on whether they're using an older system that cannot report ballot styles per batch, so forth and so on. That's one of the things that we've been agonizing over.
Hi, this is Eric from Dominion. I just want to cover a couple things that were mentioned in those last two conversations. From an operational standpoint, I would argue strongly against starting with a paper ballot and then tracing back to the CVR. There's a variety of reasons for that. I believe that Dr. Stark's comment was trying to mitigate against the fact that you may have a stack of ballots in a box, and this would catch the state where that a particular piece of paper was not counted for whatever reason, whether it was counted and the CVR was deleted or whatever or what have you. And I think that can be mitigated more on the front end of the reconciliation. At every point that paper gets transferred, there's a reconciliation of the total counts against what is counted in the system. So that chance of a ballot being in a box that did not have a CVR, I think can be mitigated in other ways. And I think coming at the process from that standpoint would create far greater operational impacts than going from a CVR to a paper ballot.
So this is Harvey Branscombe, and I can start to address both of those points. There is a strong possibility that we can have a ballot manifest that is external to the Dominion voting system and external to the cast vote record. So we actually know where the ballots are at the time they're going into the voting system, and we know what styles they are and how many there are in each batch and so forth. That is possible. It may not be in place today, but it's something we have ballot sorting or envelope sorting machines that are counting ballots, knowing the style, and except for discrepancies about what's inside the envelope, those actually can produce a ballot manifest that's close to correct and can be corrected as the envelopes are actually opened, conceivably. So there are opportunities for there to be a ballot manifest that knows where the ballots are that are separate from the cast vote record, thus allowing us to actually, in effect, randomly choose paper and then find the cast vote record to go with it. And that would be done by the cast vote record. And indeed, the cast worker might be missing. So that's, and that might depend on developing new process, maybe new software additions to systems that are in place, et cetera. The issue that Merlin Klotz brought up about the fact that there are contests to be audited that are not the full scope of the county is a serious issue for us, because it may be that the margin on those contests is very narrow, and it may cause a large amount of sampling to happen, more than we need for the statewide or the countywide. And that's why there is a strategy here that we've been discussing, which involves taking a look at the narrowest margin full county contest, which is on every ballot in the county, and then starting the sampling based on that, and then addressing the, then there are two other types of contests that are problematic. One of them is that it's in several counties and it's a portion of those counties. And then there is the type of contest that's entirely within one county and is smaller than the county. And certainly we can, at a minimum, produce a risk measurement for those that will report back how well we did as an audit after auditing based on the narrowest margin countywide contest. And then we could allow it could be up to local control at that point whether or not there is a need, there's an apparent need to go further with the audit to satisfy the stakeholders for that particular contest. And that could be something that is specified prior to the election or conceivably as the audit proceeds, conceivably. But we don't have to address this as if every contest on every ballot has to be audited to the same or even a fixed risk limit. And there are great workload issues involved in this. But one of the great things is that if we have a cast vote record county, and I'm presuming we're basically discussing cast vote record counties. Now, we do have a clerk and recorder here from a county that isn't going to have the cast vote record in this audit.
And we will get to that discussion for the counties that don't have the Dominion system. We'll get to that later. But for now, I'd just like to stay focused on the path you're on, which is...
Right. Within the cast vote record environment, then it is possible to actually, continuing with the random audit beyond the level we would have started with by satisfying the countywide risk limit, then we can actually go and find precisely the ballots that have the contest on them that need to be audited. So that's the wonderful thing that we're going to get from the fact that we have ballot manifest or cast vote record. Either one ought to be able to accomplish that.
Thank you, Harvey.
This is Dwight Shulman with the Secretary of State's office. It, just from an administrative standpoint, the potential complexities in margins, risk limits, whether these are wholly within a county or shared between counties and so forth, from an administrative standpoint, I like the idea of using the county contest with the narrowest margin as kind of the guidepost. Now, I'm very sensitive to Merlin's point, though, which is, what if we end up with a political subdivision like a municipality or a special district or a school district that has a contest on the ballot that has an even closer margin than one of those county contests? I guess in my view, even if we accept the countywide contest with the narrowest margin, we will still be able to report what essentially level of confidence we reached with those sub-county contests. And bear in mind that this is an auditing tool. Any party can always request a permissive recount if that's appropriate. This may or may not do away with the mandatory recount. I think that's a conceptual issue we need to get to way down the road. So my only point is, I think Merlin's point is well taken. The only thing I would add is we need to be sensitive to the administrative complexities of actually running one of these. And secondly, just remember, the audit itself is not the only, quote, remedy available here in the event of an extremely narrow sub-county contest.
This is Angela in Larimer, and I would like to say well said, Dwight, and thank you very much.
This is Neil McBurnett, and I think we've made some progress on actually what I think is one of the harder issues. What I wonder is, and I like what Dwight was saying and many of the other comments, but I wonder if we want to go through kind of some of the more straightforward questions and, you know, take the progress we've made here, but come back to it as there are more questions.
Yeah.
And that goes kind of for the next one, too, dealing with rare ballot styles and voter identifiable marks. Those are it might be better to try to get the most clean, straightforward audit out of the way in everyone's mind and then add some of the complexities to it. So just a suggestion in terms of agenda.
Yeah, we'll get there. Neil, I was thinking the same thing, but Danny Casillas has a comment here.
Yeah, this is Danny. There's a class of state contest, the state house, where the districts are smaller than the county. So how would those be handled as far as the countywide versus those sub? That's all I have.
Yeah, it's a pretty, I think this is a more open-ended type of thing, but we'll really need to define this scope ultimately before we define rules for it, before we're assuming audit. So I think it's something to definitely just chew on and document and really kind of wrap our heads around. So before we have our final meeting, we have some idea of which contest we're going to audit or not. But I want to just put it out there to have this discussion, because it's I think we have very similar thoughts and also very dissimilar thoughts on the contest to audit. We'll have one more comment about this topic from Harvey, and then move on to the next.
Well, anyway, I just wanted Danny's absolutely correct, and he's basically pointing out, it is, in a sense, it is a political decision. If you wanted to have countywide contests plus the legislative districts that are all legislative districts, if you wanted to define it that way, as all of those would be in the initial decision or looking for the narrowest margin, you could do so, and it wouldn't actually harm the phenomenon. It's somewhat arbitrary how you decide to begin the audit. And then you have to have ways of expanding it in order to satisfy the risk limit when you haven't met it yet. So we can say that we can start with the countywide district and say we're going to meet the risk limit for the legislative districts, and that might involve auditing more ballots.
Go ahead, Dwight. No, Danny.
I just wanted to counter that sometimes these state house districts are multi-county, so in one county the number of ballots could be very small, and that could, you know, drive you to a lot of ballots.
I think that Merlin again. I think one of the questions is the purpose that if it, pick a number, 10%, whatever, that we have to take another action. Does it change something? Does it take to a full hand count, or is it a matter of reporting? So on a city council that's coordinating on a ballot, and maybe in our sample we only pull up a half dozen voters on that particular city council district. If, in that case, maybe we report a confidence level of a small confidence level. But it's not that it's bad. It's just because of our sample size is small. If it's just a matter of reporting, it's one thing. If it's a matter of causing an action that costs us a lot of operational issues, that's a whole different story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And just to get back to Danny on that, of course he's correct. There are multi-county districts, and we're never going to say you're going to audit based on the margin of a county portion of a legislative district. That is not what we're definitely not proposed. absolutely, all the district's margins have to be determined across the entire district, whatever scope it is. So it doesn't, you can do what I said, and you wouldn't have, and that's one of the reasons why we've been aiming the audit towards having a centralized decision-making process about how many samples to pick, which samples they are, as opposed to leaving it up to the counties, because the county in your example wouldn't know what's going on in the other two counties, and so we couldn't really coordinate, right? There, we'd have to build a complicated process for each district. So we really need statewide coordination. Yeah.
And finally, we'll just wrap this up with Dwight. I said Harvey like three comments ago, but this will be Dwight, and then we'll move on.
So this was an issue that was just raised in our prior discussion, and maybe we get to it down below in our agenda here, but at some point I would like somebody to explain to me in terms that I can understand, what does it matter if we are starting with a piece of paper and going, by that I mean a ballot, and then checking the CVR, or if we are starting with a randomly selected CVR and tracing to the ballot. It seems as long as we get back and verify the original artifact submitted by the voter, that particular order doesn't matter. But I may not be understanding something here.
And Dwight, we have that part. It's in our post-election process. We can add it here to discuss, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, because that's what this discussion seems to be like. But we have that in our post-election audit part. So just to stay on point with our items here, and just to help my mind stay organized for this meeting, since we have more stuff to get to, let's move on to number three, and it may become the same similar discussion as number two, which is determine the risk limit. Are we going to have a set risk limit of say 10%, or will it vary? And if it varies, what will cause that variance? Will it be something that's set in rule, or subject to a case by case basis? And so this is something that will also need to be determined is what risk limit will we use, and what variance will it have? And so I'll just open up the discussion with that and go ahead and start with input here.
So this is Philip. The 10% number was really just being used in pilots to try to keep the workload to a minimum. I would advocate for a lower risk limit than that. I think no bigger than 5%, and there's an argument for 1%. The incremental amount of work that's involved is typically not large. If we're doing a comparison audit, at the ballot level, then, you know, you can, to divide the risk limit by 10, I think increases the workload by about a factor of 2. So to go from 10% to 1%, is doubling the number of ballots that you have to look at. I on the assumption that things are correct. And I think that as a kind of, from the public's perspective, interpreting a risk limit is not that straightforward. There's a tendency for people to think it's the chance that the outcome is wrong, which is not true. What it is it's the chance, it's the largest chance that an outcome that is wrong wouldn't be corrected. But that said, talking about something like a 10% chance that something is wrong feels a lot worse than the 5% or 1% somehow.
So this is Harvey. So actually outside of this group, but among the group that Philip's a part of, we've had pretty extensive conversations about how to convey the idea of the risk limit. And I think I'm just reiterating what Philip said, but it's not the risk that the election's wrong. So we're afraid that it will be conveyed that way by the press, and that's an issue for communications that we're going to need to work on. So we need to make it very clear that the risk limit, that it's really a much more complicated phenomenon, and it relates to whether there is an incorrect outcome or not as the starting point, and then what's the risk that you haven't found that. So you have to factor in the probability that the outcome's actually wrong, which is, we presume, relatively low. But we are trying to find out. So that's the point of setting the risk limit, is to be able to find out. And so Philip's giving the argument that increasing the risk limit, or making it more tough, is not very difficult to do. That's what he's saying. And he's saying 5%. And to be honest, we don't really know what the impact of 5% risk limit is right now. And we meaning the group outside this group, are trying to actually figure that out based on the 2016 election. And hopefully we will be able to figure out how much work that would have been at a 5% or a 10%. And we also need to decide whether we're going to call it 90% or 95 or 5, or, you know, which direction you want to describe this limit. So those are communication issues. But as for how we are going to decide it, I mean, the legislature is not going to decide it, that's for sure. So we're going to have to decide it based on how we convey that information, how much confidence it actually provides to the public. We need to be careful about that. We want to make sure there's a factual basis for whatever we are saying, and that's why it's clear we need to have that discussion. And it's not clear to me exactly how that discussion is going to work, but we need to figure it out. We do need to figure out how we're going to decide what the risk limit is actually going to be and how we're going to convey it, even more importantly.
I'm sorry, we're still cross-talking. This in the previous discussion...
Who is this speaking?
Mark, identify yourself.
Yeah, Mark Lindemann, representing the stakeholders group loosely. We have our individual voices. Part of what makes it hard to get a handle on the effect on workload is the uncertainty or the fact that we simply haven't decided which contests to subject to a risk limit. So to take every statewide contest and impose, say, a 1% risk limit instead of a 10% risk limit is doubling a pretty small workload in all but the very, very closest cases. At the other extreme, if we're trying to audit, every contest on coordinated ballots, all the hundreds of them in a presidential election, say, even to estimate what that workload is and then what it would mean to double it, it gets really hard to wrap our heads around. So what we are committed to trying to provide to the working group is sort of the clearest information. I mean, given that this is based on uncertainty, obviously we have no way of knowing how close given elections will be, but some sense of how these pieces work together, which contests are audited, and what the risk limits are.
This is Philip again. I just wanted to take a chance again, another stab at explaining what the risk limit means in other words. Yeah. A risk limit of 10%, one way of thinking about it is it means that at least 9 out of 10 incorrect outcomes would get corrected by the audit. If there are no incorrect outcomes in the first place, then 100% of the outcomes are right going in and 100% are right coming out. If there are any that are wrong going in, at least, on average, at least 90% of them would get corrected. A risk limit of, 1% would mean that, 99 out of 100 wrong outcomes would get corrected by the audit process. On average.
So this is Neil again. And one thing that I just want to point out, both for the question that Dwight asked and for this one, is that we have flexibility. We can come up with ways of selecting from the paper or from the CDRs. We can design risk limits to meet administrative issues and political will and desire for confidence and public understanding. So again, I want to take this discussion and say, very important to have. It's something that we've been wrestling with for a decade, and come back to it, having teed it up, after we kind of go through the meat and potatoes.
Yeah, and what I'd like to do with these two, number two and three, is if we could. And so two meetings from now, I don't have a calendar in front of me, but I believe it would be March 17th. If by March 17th, we do have more clear definition around what we the stakeholders, particularly what the counties feel comfortable with, because they're the ones that are going to be doing all the work. And so they're the ones that needs to be heard with this. And so, yeah, I'm fine with punting it for right now, but we do need to address it relatively soon so that we could then really define, start defining processes more thoroughly and not just leave them as they are right now, which is really vague and still cloudy. Because me personally, I don't like to live in that kind of world where things are still cloudy. But I know we will get there, but I just want to set a deadline here to really get us working towards that. And so, Dwight?
Just a couple of points. It seems, at least from the comments thus far, that a couple of things are fairly clear. Although we do not know the precise number, it seems like most people are in favor of establishing a set risk limit rather than adopting some method that varies the risk limit depending on some circumstance in the election. And then the other thing I would just like everybody to bear in mind as we discuss this in more detail on March 17th, which is this is our first crack at a risk-limiting audit rule. I think I'm safe in absolutely guaranteeing this will not be our last crack at it. This is a completely unfamiliar process to most counties, and it's a very intimidating prospect to most counties. What I would like to suggest is that we start with a risk limit of whatever it is, understanding that as our county clerks become more familiar in administering these things and we improve all the kind of related business processes, we can, depending on how we express this, either decrease or increase that risk limit in a subsequent iteration of the rule. But I think it would be a mistake for us to establish a risk limit that imposes a degree of work that sets almost every county up to fail. I would hate to start this in that way. Thanks.
Thank you, Dwight.
Merlin again. Hey, back to something that Harvey said earlier and Professor Stark said earlier. The communication of this, I have difficulties wrapping my arms around sitting here exactly what the definition is. I hate to see what the press is going to butcher it to the public. And I'm very, very concerned on whatever percentage we say, if it's 1%, that from the public, that can be horrible. And so that it scares me.
Yeah, this is Harvey. We've actually sort of discussed that topic also and recognized that other kinds of audits in the world don't usually expose the percentage of these kinds of numerical characterizations. The audit gets passed or it doesn't get passed. But it's crystal. We need to be crystal clear. You know, the people performing the audit have to be crystal clear about what they're doing and what is good enough and what isn't. But communicating to the rest of the world, it doesn't have to be at the same level, obviously.
Yeah, and the way that I've been framing this for a long time, this is Neil again, is that many of the processes used today in elections around the world, I mean, we're paving new ground in doing great auditing here. And many of the existing procedures, according to the definition here and definitions that I've used of just effectiveness of audits for a long time, give zero chance of correcting a wrong outcome. That's where we're starting from. And I would stand up in front of the press anytime and say, we are starting from, with no aspersions to anyone here or elsewhere, we're starting from risk of cyber attack or mistake or bug or all kinds of things that could overturn our elections and with no protection. So the wonderful thing here is that with usually a very small amount of effort, we can produce fabulous expert that the security professionals of the world have been pushing for a long time and really respect. So I absolutely agree that we have to frame it right. And I just want you to know that I'm behind you, right? I'm going to frame it in terms of, we don't think there are hardly ever problems with elections, but we know there could be, and we want to rest assured that there haven't been, and this is all we have to do it. We don't have to recount. We can just do a risk-limiting audit.
Thank you, Neil. And I put in my notes to add communication to the next outline when we have our next meeting to discuss that more thoroughly of how we will communicate this to the public and the counties and other interested parties, because that is an important discussion to have. But right now in the scope of today's meeting, I'd like to just move on. Number four, determine how to handle various ballot issues. I think we can all agree that that's something we can work on at a later time, since it'll be a little more beneficial to tackle some of these other items. I didn't put these items in any kind of chronological order, just an order just to be able to discuss these items and be just focused on one topic at a time. So right now, let's just move on to number five, determine when to conduct the audit. Neil and Harvey, in their comments that they submitted to me, suggested beginning 9 days after the election and concluding 13 days after the election. And so I want to start there to see if anyone, particularly the counties, what their thoughts are and when to start the audit.
That's all dependent on the first two or three, on number two and number three. The complexity of it, how far down we've got to go, if we've got to get down to Council District 3, that's a whole different equation. You can't start with the days and then back up to how much what's going into it.
So just to explain the rationale for, and there are considerable discussions and controversies among us outside of this group, this room here, about whether there should be auditing happening after election day and prior to the ninth day. There's a simplicity that comes from starting the whole state at the same time, which means that all of the sampling can be done at one time. And the whole state can be basically the sampling decision can be made at one time, and it's not necessary to have several different sets of sampling decisions made for any given county. So that's a level of simplicity. It's also true that existing audits typically happen after the, but not always. There are counties that are auditing prior to the eighth day. So I think that's the primary argument for. The argument on the other side is if it turns out, and we already know there's a narrow margin election that's going to involve a lot of auditing, the 13th day is actually the day for canvass for the primary. The 17th day is for the general election. But you can actually, we could organize a scenario where there's a case where you can start early and go to a more complex sampling solution. And the other thing to mention about this in terms of the whole time frame of the audit is if the audit's going to head towards a recount, if you're going to be counting a lot of ballots, we have a transition point at which we're going to switch over to the recount. And under the recount phenomenon, you have more time. It's no longer limited by the 13 or the 17 days. So both of those things need to be kept in mind. That it all has to package together. So the transition from the sampled audit into the full recount is going to involve an additional amount of time. And so we just need to figure out how to make sure the audit can be conveniently accomplished, or the portion of it before it switches to a recount can be done in time.
Harvey, this is Merlin again. Harvey, I agree with you to the extent that we're dealing only in statewide contests. If we're dealing with every contest on the ballot, again, that gets back to how we define number two and number three, then we could end up essentially at 100% hand count.
So this is Harvey. So
that's not likely to happen if you actually have a ballot manifest that tells you where to look for particular contests. The kind of sample sizes we're talking about are, for a for 10% risk limit, it's something like 5 divided by the margin. So if you have a 1% margin, you're looking at something like 500 ballots. If you have a 10% margin, you're looking at something like 50 ballots from the contest in question. So if you know where to go for the ballots in the contest in question, if you've got the procedures in place that track where the ballots are, that's not a lot of looking.
So this is Harvey. I think Merlin is correct. If you were to attempt to get all of this small contest to the same risk limit as the large ballot contest, you could end up easily recounting often. But that's not our anticipated plan. So there may be specific and probably locally decided races where the canvas board decides they need to audit a particular narrow margin, small contest that's within a county, but you certainly don't need to sample all the ballots in order to get there. You just specifically sample the ones that are on the ballot manifest for that contest.
Dwight?
This is Dwight from the Secretary of State's office. I'll be honest, the starting 9 days after and having to conclude, it actually shouldn't be necessarily 13. It should be the deadline for certifying official results for whatever election we're talking about. But as Harvey points out, in the case of a primary election, that gives you 4 days. Wow. That concerns me. One thing in the back of my mind is having a provision of this rule that permits the Secretary of State to waive or excuse strict compliance with the official certification deadline, which really the ultimate deadline is the date by which we have to do the statewide abstract, which is substantially after the counties must certify their official results. This is going to be complicated, and I just want to have an escape valve in case we have a county who's in trouble. It's more important to me that the audit be done correctly and that the certified results everybody has confidence in, rather than strictly complying with what is kind of an arbitrary deadline. So
Dwight, what are your thoughts on when to start? Because you've worked in a county and know that the workload of what happens after an election. So what are your thoughts on
Well, I agree with Harvey in that starting the audit after the full universe of ballots have been tabulated adds a lot of simplicity to it. In the case of a primary election, a 4-day turnaround on a risk-limiting audit really concerns me. I don't know if that's doable in each and every circumstance. I think it would be nice if we could figure out a way for a county to start earlier and still arrive at the same statistical confidence as we add additional tabulated ballots. Because as we are now under Colorado's random post-election audit, we have counties that are starting that literally within 48 to 72 hours of election day.
So this is Neil, and I guess my mantra today sounds like it's going to be, we've got flexibility for you. First of all, we're not going to have to deal with a primary until after we get experience this November. So, as you say, we might rewrite the rule and figure out how to do it well at that point. Eventually, my guess is that in most cases, it's going to be best to just wait until all the ballots are in and then do the audits. My hope in most counties is that it's, I want things to be done the morning you start the audit. There will obviously be cases that'll be a lot harder if we're dealt with a situation where it's a really tight margin. And if that's the case, again, we have flexibility. We can say, oh, wow, you know, that was a squeaker. We're going to start auditing right away. And we have ways to do that that will allow you to, you know, get whatever head start you want. And in case there's just like one county that's really close, I don't know, the spirit that I sense in Colorado is we all want things to work together. We might pitch in and help them. And so I don't know. I guess I still see flexibility here.
And would it make sense to try to gather data on when counties really have finished tabulating all of the ballots to get a good sense of when an audit can start? Because I know from experience that some counties are they have tabulated all their ballots within a day or two after the election, but I don't know for certain how many actually take the whole 8 days after the election to get that final tabulation. So would it make sense to get that information to determine when to start the audit? Or do we just, Jimmy, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think you just have to look at the deadlines for provisional ballots and signature cures. And once those have been met, then essentially you can say that all your ballots have been tabulated at that point.
And that's...
I don't know that the deadline's right off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But it's eight days, right? So, yeah, so that's where the 9 days is coming from. So, yep.
And so does that make sense as the starting date then?
Or? Yeah, because, I mean, technically you won't have all your ballots, your potential ballots tabulated until that deadline's met anyway. So.
Yeah, this is Philip. I mean, if it can be squeezed in to the time, I think it's much better to have resolved the status of provisional ballots, done the signature verification on mail-in ballots, so forth and so on, before you start. It just really simplifies the logistics, but it does compress the time scale. And my guess is that most of that 9-day period is devoted to doing things like resolving provisional status.
Yeah, that's correct. And Jerome, I'm not sure it makes sense to do any kind of survey on this. Most counties, I think, actually reserve a chunk of election night ballots just so, like, if they receive one signature cure, they can stick that ballot in a batch that lends anonymity or secrecy. I never remember, Harvey, what the proper term is. But so I don't think we want to encourage counties to determine that their tabulation is complete before all of the statutory deadlines expire.
Okay, that makes sense. I've never worked in the county and never worked in elections until this job, so some of you know a lot more about some of that stuff than me. So I think we can, for this one, have a come to consensus that it starts 9 days after the election. I mean, unless there's really... I think we'll have special circumstances that we may need to waver on, but I mean, this is something that we should define clearly as to when the ballot will start, unless there's really, I guess, strong opposition to having it start then. I don't necessarily agree with having a date. It has to conclude, an absolute date it has to conclude by, especially this year when... a lot of counties are getting a new voting system on top of a lot of other new things they're getting. And so I think it would be unfair to expect that from counties to say, hey, and by the way, 4 days later, we want this to conclude. I just don't think we should put that cap on them just because it just doesn't make sense at this point to do that.
This is Dwight again, just real quick. We know for 2017, I think that's what we should focus on because, again, we're going to keep fine-tuning this rule. We have until 17 days after, which is a larger, more comfortable window. The other thing we might consider doing, and I'll just throw this out to Merlin, maybe personally I don't understand why the deadline for canvass is so quick after a primary election. I don't see another statutory need for it. We might be able to get legislative relief on that and have that extended you know, it could be next year's legislative session where we can maybe talk to the legislature about pushing that back to 17 days as well.
And Dwight, you brought up a good point, and something I didn't think about when I was going through this stuff is focusing on 2017. So I think a good place to kind of a good time frame to start working from is focusing just on 2017 for now, because that'll give us a good definition of time as far as deadlines that are happening for this election. And then even as we get more into the work of this, working off, and I'm open to feedback here, but working off the assumption that for this year's election, doing if there's a statewide contest, just focusing on the statewide contest. But while we're talking about when to conduct the audit, why don't we just discuss that a little more? Does it make sense to focus this round on the 2017 coordinated election, or should we be looking at the 2018 when we're going to have the just more moving pieces? So what are the thoughts of the group here with that time frame, and if we have a statewide contest, just focusing the audit on the statewide contest?
I don't have an objection to that. I think there's a substantial chance we won't have a statewide contest in 2017, at least at this point. So just if whatever the rule says, we need a default position. You know, statewide is fine, but if none, then countywide, or, you know, the largest district within the county or what have you.
So this is Harvey, and I believe there's another reason that we should not exclude consideration of the 2018 election, or even maybe the 2020 election, and that's because we have so much help right now and so much interest focused on this process right here, that if we were to just arbitrarily exclude, hey, that's a statewide, let's not talk about it now, or we're not going to see that this year, we really should at least go over those and include them in our conversation, just not get bogged down and stuck in a mud hole, you know, and not get beyond there.
And that's what I mean, Harvey, is just, okay, you know, not getting bogged down with details of something that's, I mean, we're still going to have to address it, but discuss it, but just not get bogged down with that for the purposes of getting a working documentation for this, the next couple of months here with our group.
This is Philip. So by far the easiest audits to operationalize are those that are going to happen at the countywide level. They don't require coordination across jurisdictions. They occur, the contest appears on every ballot in the county. The county can kind of do its own thing in order to you know, start and finish the audit. The next easiest thing are things that are statewide, because, again, they appear on every ballot in each jurisdiction. The difficulty then becomes coordinating audits when different jurisdictions' voting systems have different capabilities. The difference between systems that can report individual CBRs matched to ballots and those that can only give you, you know, precinct-based totals or batch-based totals, that kind of heterogeneity is still hard to deal with operationally in comparison to what could happen for the individual county. Personally, I would vote for rolling things out basically in that order, to shoot first to do the statewide and countywide contests and then phase in the smaller contests. That said, I would also want to do the whole thing starting at a fairly, you know, small risk limit, not 10%, but say 5%. So 5% for statewide and countywide, and then figure out how to do the smaller contests and what risk limit to look for there.
Thank you, Philip. Anybody else have any other thoughts on that particular topic? I agree with him with doing countywide and statewide for this year's election, especially if we don't have a statewide contest. Okay, we have a, sorry for those who aren't in this room, there's a, sounds like a protest outside of our building. We're connected to Wells Fargo, which gets a lot of action lately. So for those that are in this room, if that's a protest outside this building, we'll be locked down until they give us further direction. Yes, that is a security concern. We just got email yesterday that if there is a protest here, the building will be locked down. You should be able to exit out of the second floor if need be, but just as for those in the room, precaution there. That's per our building management. Number six, let's move on to number six. Audit oversight. Who will be overseeing the audit? And Neil and Harvey have an idea of the state creating an audit center. You can read in more detail in Harvey's and Neil's documentation on our website about that. I didn't want to include a whole lot because I didn't also want to misstate or misrepresent what their goal is. So that's why I just want to state that verbally. But starting at the county role, I guess we can even just flip that and start at the state side of how much oversight should the state have when it comes to risk limiting audits. Should we have an audit center and be the central authority on all audits or just statewide contest? And this may come down to a policy type decision, but I just want to throw this out there because there were comments about this particular topic. So Neil, it looks like you have some comments.
Well, the first thing I just want to jump in with is to really make as clear as I can that while I emailed the document to you and Harvey emailed the document to you, those documents came out of a brain trust of some amazingly bright and dedicated folks all over the country. So there's lots of folks there, and we've got names in there, and we didn't even name everybody because some people are shy and some people, you know. So it's not just Harvey and me. And as Harvey says, there are things that we each have personal opinions about that don't always mesh, which is, you know, because we don't all know everything that you all know and what's going to work out. So, exactly.
Well, yeah. They're just comments submitted by yeah. YouTube. So, you understanding know, that a lot of people put work into this.
Well, we're proud of them, but we want to credit all kinds of people. So, in terms of how to manage this, we have experience with county level audits. We've got them in California. We've had them in Boulder. We've done, you know, the Corla project to do that. We've got that experience. I think that knowing, in this case, really coming back to what we said a second ago, knowing that in 2018 and beyond, and even this year, there are going to be some contests that, you know, are probably school districts that cross county boundaries and so on. We're going to need coordination. And I can think of no better way to dip our toes into how that actually works than to say, let's try to coordinate it from one place. Now, you know, if there are political considerations or other things that I don't know about, I don't want to jump into any minefields, but it makes sense to me to try to have, to focus the coordination in a local way in terms of just providing the data to everyone. And at the same time, to give all kinds of flexibility and credit to the counties in how they actually manage the mechanics. You know, we're not, as we talked 2 weeks ago, we're not trying to tell you how many ballots to put in your batches or how to manage your paper. You know, just know that these are the things, the questions that are going to come are, we want you to look at these ballots. Please go find them and come back and report on them. So I think that it helps to do a central thing, but I've probably talked more than I should already. So I really want to hear from the counties.
The counties have a look on this.
Could I jump in? This is Philip.
Sure.
So I agree with everything that Neil said. there needs to be coordination of any audit that crosses jurisdictional boundaries. So that's the statewide things, but also presumably legislative districts and other things are going to cut across boundaries. And a number of advantages to having some kind of central entity that coordinates things. First of all, it can deal with that issue of the logistics. Secondly, it means that reporting the audit results is in essence automatic if it's using a hosted solution, you know, at this entity. Third, it means that we know everybody's on the same page in terms of versions of software and things like that. If they're basically using, again, a web application to do this kind of thing, any bug fixes or whatever happens simultaneously for everybody. It just seems like it streamlines a lot of aspects of the audit. Now, whether that's something that's happening under the SOS's office or, you know, an independent auditing board, or I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what the politics are. But it does seem that there's a big advantage to doing this.
Merlin again. I look at CD4, for example. I think it probably covers, six, eight, 10 different counties. Now, I'll gladly dump this back to Dwight and Judd to handle the risk-limiting audit on that. Operationally, it's one thing to say coordinate. It's something else to say functionally, how do we do something like that?
Yeah. Well, so again, this is why Jerome has zeroed in on a lot of the toughest questions when we haven't even kind of gone through the simple scenarios. And the way that I would handle that simple scenario, that scenario, the easiest way that comes to my mind is to sample from the cast vote records. And to do that, although we could also do it from the paper, and it might even vary. Well, it'd be hard for it to vary that by contest, but maybe by election if there was some real big reason to do it a different way. But the point is, yeah. So the point is, if we start off with risk limits that give us the amount to audit based on countywide contest, we're going to hit some of those randomly when we do our sampling. And if we sample from the cast vote records, then we can find very easily the ones that match the district that we care about if we don't get enough of them to start with. And that's all assuming that we're actually demanding a risk limit for that district. So there's a lot of moving pieces, and I think that we have a lot of flexibility.
And I think Neil's going too deep, actually. What you're asking is simply answered by you provide the election results to the Secretary of State, as you already do, and you provide the ballot manifest, which you don't do, but that's where the ballots are, what styles they are, and then the and eventually you provide the cast vote record files to the Secretary of State. They have a system that takes all that material together. They run a random number generator, and they match up specific randomly generated numbers up to your ballot manifest and the ballot manifest of all the other counties involved. And they send back to you or put on a website, here are the specific ballots you audit in this order, and right now we need the first 10. And then you audit those. You actually send back the what amounts to a handmade cast vote record. Maybe it's on a spreadsheet or something, but you've basically had your election judges or your audit board look at the ballots, those 20 or whatever it is, and you will provide the data. It goes back to the Secretary of State's office. They will compare. You can compare too if you like, but they will compare against the machine-generated cast vote record, and then they will tell you your audit's done or we need more, and you already know which ones are the future ones you could audit, so you may have already audited them. That's the simple answer.
That's something like I visualized it, but I didn't know if Dwight was on board with that and able to do it in 4 days.
Right. We haven't heard from Dwight. Yeah. It's all going to be online and beautiful.
Yeah, so when Harvey says you provide a ballot manifest, a, for lack of a better term, man-made cast vote record and a machine-generated cast vote record to the Secretary of State's office, and we have magical software that automatically does everything. Ben, if you would just note, we need the magical software because that there's I'm concerned about the amount of development that that we need to do and our limited resources for that. First of all, I think having a centralized location or clearinghouse for the information makes a lot of sense. Because ultimately, this entire exercise is intended to give the electorate a higher level of confidence than that what we are doing in elections actually is a correct outcome. And having that information just immediately available for anybody who's interested, I think serves that purpose. On the other hand, in reading Harvey's submission, particularly for this meeting, I guess I wasn't anticipating that the Secretary of State would be randomly selecting for each county the ballots or cast vote records that need to be examined. And I'm not entirely sure I understand the utility of that if we instead provide a tool that tells the counties, you know, you do the random number generation, you randomly select the ballots and CVRs that need to be examined and report back to us.
So this is Neil. First of all, I hope people out there don't have the impression that we're going to have like people making phone calls saying this is what I saw on this ballot and Dwight, does that look good? And Dwight says, wait, let me get back to you. You know, we do have software that can do this. I know of at least two implementations that do this sort of thing. They're both either already shared online or to be shared online, open source. You know, they're not polished pieces of software yet, at least mine isn't. But it's actually not that hard a thing to do. And I expect that we will, you know, work out ways to make that happen and get all kinds of feedback from counties as to whether it works well and so on. I think that we can make convenient web forms to make that whole process. You know, a county will instantly know. They enter in, you know, what they see on the ballot, and it says, yep, that matches the cast vote records we have on hand. We're making progress. Let us know what the next one is. You know, so I think that can be made pretty straightforward. But we absolutely need, you know, your feedback in terms of how to make it straightforward.
Well, and what I'd like to get from this is what role the state will have, and then also what roles the county will have, and if there are counties that would really want more control than just having the state oversee it. I mean, I see the benefit of having a central type system to help coordinate this, but I'd like to hear from any counties that are online if they have any thoughts on this, and if not right now, if they have time to think about it within their own staff and provide written comments to us regarding some of these topics that hit a little closer to home for them. To be able to get their feedback on this and instead of it just being people who don't work in a county and who have to actually do the work, it'd be helpful to hear from them, whether in these calls or by way of written comments. Harvey, did you have
a comment? I do have. I sort of indirectly received a comment from a county, which I think is relevant here. And it's slightly amusing, but I think it's meaningful, and that is that in Guilford County, where they actually have a legalized gambling, they do not want to see dice rolled in the county building, and that would be a horrible thing for them to be doing, and they'd be lynched the next day, possibly. So, and they would prefer, I believe, they would prefer to have it done by the state. If there's going to be a dice roll, they'd like it to be done for the whole state. It's simpler to do it at the state level.
Yeah.
And it's more overseeable, and Neil and I and everybody else who's interested in this will be at the Secretary of State's office helping out instead of trying to be at every county trying to help out, where or it's not quite understood why we're doing this or what, how we pick the ballots. I was wondering, Dwight, which of the sort of two different things that we were talking about was going to be the difficult one for you, and you picked the one I didn't expect, which is setting the sample, which samples to, doing the random number generation. That seems like the easy part, and we're almost there. And maybe a harder part is just comparing the manual cast vote records to the machine cast vote records, which sort of needs to be done by some independent authority somehow, but it's a pretty trivial operation. It could be done in a spreadsheet. We don't need special made software to do that, really. But you could make it automated, you know, and automatically go on the
Excuse
website.
Excuse me, Harvey, could you just talk in the microphone?
Okay, sorry. I get it, yeah. So,
This is Dwight again. Comparison of the manually created cast vote record to the machine, I mean, what we're talking about is just developing a business process to enable us to do that. As my real concern about this, selfishly, as the county support manager for the elections division, is accurately communicating to 64 counties simultaneously all the information that they need. I know that sounds like it should be relatively straightforward. I can tell you from my own personal experience, it often isn't. But again, systems, whatever that ends up looking like, can help with that. I just want to make sure that whatever we do, number one, we need to be comfortable with the fact that we have the human and information resources available to do this. And number two, that it's just as easy and straightforward as it can be for the counties. We just don't need to give them any more complexity in their lives. So.
Thank you, Dwight. And along the role of, or idea of the county's role, and one thing they will do, and they do it now in their current process, is appointing an audit board to assist with the details we'll get to here briefly. And then on both the state and the county level, the state will be conducting RLA trainings starting in about a month from now at their regional clerks meetings. But then the also assisting the counties with developing training for their judges. So it's a really big undertaking, and it's like way easier to say in words that, oh, we'll just provide some training. But there's going to be a lot of hands-on type training, and one of the major roles of the county will be training their judges on conducting an RLA. So as Dwight said, we do need to make this as straightforward and easy for the counties to digest, so that when it does come time to conducting the audit, we know what we're doing. The counties know what they're doing, and there's not confusion, because as we know here at the state, when we've rolled out new systems, it all sounds great and it looks pretty, but then come election night, come the day before the election, our phones are blowing up because there's just there was miscommunication or a bug in the system that nobody predicted. And so those are things that we have to consider if the state's going to be take the oversight of the audit, is also downstream effects of things that we institute to make sure that the counties have the support they need for these things that we do. Whatever systems and processes we use, that has to be at the forefront of our minds is how does this affect the counties, the people that actually will be conducting this. Harvey, we'll let you have one more comment, and then I'd like to move on to the RLA procedures section of our outline here.
Right. Okay, this is
Harvey. Jerome, this is Janice out at Pickett County. I want to make a comment as well. I can wait until Harvey's done.
Okay.
Okay, I was just going to say that it might be wise for this group to make clear right now that the conduct of the election, absent the audit, is of higher priority. And so if there turns out to be some conflict between the two, that this installation of the risk limiting audit is going to step in front of any other step in the conduct of the election. So
at least that should, every county should be aware of that. I mean, we, I can't say it, but somebody else who can write a rule can say it.
Yeah. This is Janice. While I appreciate and feel that the Secretary of State should oversee the regulation of it, we conducted a pilot last, I'm looking at Greg, last summer, and we didn't have a problem utilizing the tool that was provided to us, putting the information in it, and then proceeding. We would have, obviously, if we share that information with you, Jerry, and receive that, is there a way to double-check or review to assess that it's done properly? Just a question. The other thing I wanted to express that I appreciate earlier is the discussion with everybody that this is a huge elephant, and that to approach it, that we're taking a bite off the elephant at a time by focusing on 2017, but while keeping in front of us that we can make things better, that we can change that as we go along, as we go into 2018, I appreciated that conversation because I didn't make the last meeting, and Greg filled me in, and that was my reaction to listening to everything, how we were going to get this all done. So thank you.
Thank you, Janice.
This is Philip. Can I jump in briefly?
Sure.
I'm delighted to hear that the tool worked well for you guys. Doing it for cross-jurisdictional contests, there are ways to do that where each county draws its own sample, but those are very inefficient in that they require looking at far more ballots than methods that draw the sample from the top down across all of the jurisdictions that are involved in the contest. So in terms of the logistics of this and what software could provide, it's feasible for counties to do their own random sampling to decide which ballots to look at random or contests that are entirely contained in those counties. But once you cross a jurisdictional boundary, it's much more efficient to be drawing a random sample across the jurisdictions, and that really does call for some central coordination. Once you're doing that, then there's an issue of do you have more than one tool, can a jurisdiction start early? If it's ready to start early on a contest that's contained entirely in that jurisdiction, how do you deal with things like that?
Thank you, Philip. I think just from the comments I've heard today, and it seems like we are probably going down the path of the state being that central piece and the coordinating piece, and that probably will be the path, but I'm not going to say that's absolute, just because that's not my position, and to do that. But that will be decided over the next few months. I wanted, in this last 35 minutes of our meeting today, wanted to go to the RLA procedure section of our document, and get down to the details of this. And what I'd like to start with, just to make it a little easier to digest and consume, is running it off the assumption of this being a statewide contest. So developing these procedures based off of that assumption, and then I think we can work then down, going to the countywide and any other races below that. So if anybody doesn't have any objection, I think that's would be a good starting point, is assuming this is for a statewide contest, to be able to actually start working out the details of the actual conducting of the audit. So if we can keep our comments directed to that assumption that this is a statewide contest, that would be beneficial, I think, to everybody to be able to start really putting some meat to these words, and producing things that procedures and stuff and rules that we could that can be utilized in the counties. So starting at number one, the pre-election, and I just listed, like I said earlier, this is in no particular order. But I put download a ballot manifest, but I think before that, we need to define a ballot manifest. Starting with defining a ballot manifest, what is it? You know, what what information will go into the ballot manifest, and even including in this is will the state have a utility, a website, an online form, or will we leave, or will we create a template for the counties to follow, or will we just let the counties use their own form? So let's start there with the ballot manifest, and I'd like to just get input from the group on what they feel that is, and let's just go from there. So if anybody has comments, I'd just like to open that up, the discussion up for that right now.
So this is Harvey.
Okay.
And this is the time when I get to answer Dwight about his question. Why is it important that, why would it be important that we start with the paper instead of the cast vote record, right? That, and this relates to the ballot manifest, what function the ballot manifest has. So the reason is because we're attempting an evidence-based election, and of those two things, it's the paper ballot that's the evidence, not the cast vote record. So the cast vote record is actually an intermediate, untrustable item that we are, in effect, validating through the course of the audit by randomly selected and selecting and comparing it to paper, but it's the paper we're actually auditing. And so we basically want to start with making sure that we are going to potentially touch every piece of paper. And were we to start with the cast vote record, we're already assuming that the cast vote record actually represents every piece of paper in some, at least the existence of the paper, if not what's on it. And that could be wrong. So that's why ideally we'll have a ballot manifest that isn't actually the cast vote record. It is actually something that reflects that somebody knows that there is a specific ballot, preferably of a specific style, in a specific batch, in a specific box, in a specific room, in a specific county. So my understanding is that's what the ballot manifest looks like, and each county currently probably keeps that kind of information, maybe not down to the level of style, but in large counties they probably do, because in fact they have equipment that's actually automatically, robotically binking in the envelopes as they come in, and it knows where they are and so forth. And there's a privacy issue that requires separation of the envelopes from the ballots. So I'm not trying to, I want to acknowledge that that problem exists. But a ballot manifest is, you know, in a small county, it could be when the ballot's removed from the envelope, it goes in a particular pile, you know how many there are, and maybe you don't know what styles are in there, but you know which, how many ballots there are, in what batch, in what box, or what room, and so forth. That's the ballot manifest.
This is Dwight. So I understand your point about ultimately getting back to the paper artifact. I still do not understand why we necessarily need to start with the paper artifact. But I'm not sure I honestly care that much one way or the other. The question about the ballot manifest that I think is really, really important is, for, first of all, not every county uses an automated envelope sorter. The larger counties do, the smaller counties do not. Secondly, many counties make efforts to disassociate their tabulation batches from their score absentee ballot batches to preserve voter anonymity. And what that leads me, and I think that's a good practice. I think that's something we should encourage. So as a result of that, the ballot manifest for purposes of a risk-limiting audit is, I think, almost always going to be a manually created document, probably in the form of a spreadsheet. And as a result, I think the fields or the information in there really needs to be minimized. Requiring Denver that tabulated, how many votes, ballots did you guys have? 340,000 ballots. Requiring a ballot manifest that identifies for each, within each batch, the ballot styles contained in that batch
it's just not possible to do it. It may be possible to do it badly. It's not going to be possible to do it accurately. So I just submit to the group that the ballot manifest should contain the scanning device, the batch number, the number of ballots within that batch, and their storage location for purposes of retrieval. I think further breaking that down and saying this batch contains so many ballot style whatever, I think we're getting into the realm of the impossible.
This is Eric from Dominion. So I am going to chime in here and piggyback off of you, Dwight, that my comment earlier about starting with the CVR is all about operational efficiency and being pragmatic that at the end of the day, we need to provide a way of actually conducting these audits. I understand the theoretical assumption or statement that the CVR is untrusted, which is why we're doing these audits to begin with. If you can match, and you do match, that the number of records in the CVR matches the number of ballots that were counted, that were reconciled through every part of the process, then we know that the number of ballots in those boxes are accounted for, there's a record in the CVR. Or we can start with that assumption. And through the audit process, we can verify that, yes, we look at this CVR, it says it's this ballot style, and guess what? When we go to that box, we get that ballot style, then we can audit the results themselves.
Merlin here, one of the few times I agree with Harvey. As a CPA, I always want to start with a source document. The source document is that paper ballot, and I agree at the same time with what Dwight has suggested. Operationally, the manifest gets pretty cumbersome when in a central scan process, the ballots are all random, and within a given batch of 100 ballots, we could have any permutation of our 277 ballots in there styles in there. And so this is where it gets kind of interesting. But as a CPA, I always want to start with a source document. It eliminates the risks.
This is Philip. May I jump in?
Yes.
So first of all, on what the ballot manifest needs to contain and where information for different things comes from. If we don't have detailed information about the ballot styles that are contained in a particular box, then there is no way to sample efficiently from small contests, from contests that don't span the whole county. And that's going to lead to touching an awful lot more paper and lead to full counts more often. So to take advantage of the fact that there are counties that have voting systems that at least report what the ballot styles are supposed to be in a given batch of things and the order in which they are, that's going to be essential to making this efficient for contests that are smaller than countywide or statewide. On what to trust and how to trust it and how to double check it, I agree with Harvey that the most straightforward way to do this is to go get a piece of paper selected at random from the ballot manifest and then check the CVR. That said, you can work out the math so that if you have an independent upper bound on how much paper there is, you know that there are at most 1 million ballots in Denver or whatever the right number is, then part of what, I forgot your name, I'm sorry, the gentleman from Dominion, you know, was saying actually can work. So if you know that you've got an upper bound on how much paper you have, you've got a certain number of CVRs, the CVR contains in it information about where the corresponding piece of paper is supposed to be. You can verify that information never has two CVRs pointing to the same piece of paper. That's absolutely crucial. Then you can still follow through the math and get a risk-limiting audit, even if you start by drawing the CVRs. But there are special rules involved in what happens if the CVR tells you to look in a particular box in a particular place, and in fact, there aren't that many pieces of paper in the box. Conversely, to make sure that the other direction doesn't happen too often, you need an upper bound on the number of pieces of paper. Ideally, that upper bound on the number of pieces of paper is coming from the manual procedures involved in doing ballot accounting, ballot logging, all of those other things, not coming from the voting system. But if we do have that, then it is that you can work out the math in such a way, even if you're relying on the voting system to produce the list of ballot styles that are contained in a given batch, you can do the audit in such a way that that is automatically double-checked, and if there's a discrepancy, in general, it'll cause the audit to expand.
Well, this is I want to just interject here, just to kind of keep us on point for defining the ballot manifest, and I think we can just kind of make the statement that we'll agree to disagree, or when I say we, I mean since we have some people who say go to the paper first, then the CVR, and others who are saying CVR, you could go to the CVR first, then the ballot. Why don't we just leave that as an agree to disagree type topic for right now, since I don't want to keep talking about the same thing in different topics here. And so I'd like to just stay on point to define the ballot manifest. And what should be the content of the ballot manifest? So should we identify the device it was scanned on? And then also, when I think of a ballot manifest, I think of how many ballots are in each batch, how many batches are in this container. And I don't even think about ballot style because in the case of the smaller counties, it's impossible to identify ballot styles because they don't have the high-speed scanners that the bigger counties have that can do that function. And so I think we need to not focus on ballot styles being included in a ballot manifest, but probably more of number of ballots so that the number of ballots from the ballot manifest match the number of CVRs and doing that check. So I'd like to clearly define the content of the ballot manifest for this one particular topic right now so we can start moving forward with and if we can I know there are a lot of strong thoughts on Riesling audits as a whole and the different parts of it, but if we can just try to stay focused on these topics for right now that we're addressing and at the appropriate time discuss the things that are a little more contentious in that appropriate time frame.
Right.
This is Philip again. So at a bare minimum, in order to do a risk-limiting audit, you need to know how many ballots you have in all and how they're organized. You need to know they're in 117 boxes. Box 1 contains this many. Box 2 contains that many. Without that, you're dead in the water. But if a jurisdiction is capable of also saying, I have this many of this ballot style, this many of that ballot style in the box, that jurisdiction can do an awful lot less work in auditing smaller contests. So I think that the ideal way to set this up is the bare minimum that you need for a ballot manifest is how many ballots in all, how they're organized. But if a jurisdiction can provide more information, then it can more efficiently audit smaller contests.
Thank you, Philip. I appreciate that.
This is Harvey. I think we can reframe this conversation as asking the question whether the ballot manifest is the cast vote record or not. That's what we're actually talking about. And I'm ready to concede the point that we should not insist that the ballot style is in the ballot manifest. And I think there's good reason, and Jerome is correct about that. Dwight's correct about that. I've heard that stated before. It's better if we could have a ballot style in the ballot manifest. But is the ballot manifest actually going to be the cast vote record? And Dwight doesn't put the location of the ballot in the cast vote record as it happens, but Dwight wants to put the scanning device in the ballot manifest, which I think forces it to be basically the cast vote record. So that means it's coming from the voting system because that's how you know there's a scanning device in the first place, whereas the ballot manifest can come into existence before the ballot reaches the scanner. And ideally it would because it will give you more information about the chain of custody and it refers to the paper as opposed to only what paper reached the scanner. So I would say do not put the device number into the ballot manifest. Allow the ballot manifest to be created before the voting system actually scans the paper, if we can. And if we can't, then we get it from the voting system. And then the and in order to solve the problem of finding the rare contests in the mass of ballots, we actually use the combination of the ballot manifest and the cast vote record, not using the cast vote record for what was voted on the ballot, but just what style is on the ballot. So when those two records are put together, then the ballot manifest effectively shows what style is on the ballot. So
this is Philip again. It's absolutely crucial that the cast vote record include the location of the ballot. It has to tell you where to go find it. Otherwise, you don't have a link between the cast vote record and the paper.
This is Dwight. I completely agree with you, Philip. To me, the ballot manifest is not the cast vote record. It is the roadmap that you use to find the piece of paper that corresponds to a cast vote record for purposes of the audit. I actually don't think it is necessary. My suggestion of including the scanning device, that is a legacy thought pattern of mine from the random audits when we were auditing devices, not elections. I agree with you, Harvey. It doesn't need to be included. I disagree with you that the ballot manifest should be created before it hits a tabulator. I think as a practical matter, it must be created by the counting judges who say, this is batch number whatever. It contains however many of ballots, and it is stored in bin number whatever. I really think that is all that the ballot manifest needs to contain, because, again, it's just a way of finding the piece of paper so that you can begin the process of auditing it.
So this is Neil, and I'm glad that we're getting more agreement around a bunch of those points. You know, I come back to where Jerome framed this, and it was for statewide elections, and the ballot for the purpose of auditing that statewide contest, the ballot style is unitary. Every ballot has every contest. So, you know, that's the easy one. And I think as we gain experience and as we learn how to figure out, or people are, you know, want to go through the details of how to audit the really tough ones, the really small elections, the ones where it does matter what the style is, we can come to that bridge later on.
Thank you, Neil.
So my concern about constructing the ballot manifest after the tabulation is, what if you forget to tabulate a box of ballots? That seems to be, nationally at least, one of the most common errors. Just something doesn't end up getting scanned, or something gets scanned twice.
Yeah, let me just respond to that real quick. This is Dwight. Counties do this in the ordinary course anyway, but at least in Colorado, the vast majority of ballots are submitted by mail. Our election rules require that the counties receive into our voter registration database the return envelopes containing the voted ballots immediately. And counties will be able, should be able to know, unless something has gone completely off the rails, which admittedly is a possibility, but if their total ballots cast in from the voting system is less than the number of ballots reflected as being received, less any signature discrepancies, if there's a delta there, they know they have a box of ballots that still needs to be tabulated. And that's really external to the tabulation process, at least in Colorado, Philip.
Merlin again. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah. Philip?
Yes?
Were you going to say something?
That's terrific. No, I just, that's terrific. You have an independent check that the ballot manifest is sensible and counts for every piece of paper. That's really what we're looking for.
Okay.
Okay. In Douglas County's approach, the batches are formed at the very upfront and followed through. So the one ballot that we lost 3 years ago, we found from the cameras and found the tray it was in. So a batch is a batch is a batch through the whole process. I do question taking a simplistic view at this point, because it potentially leads us down a road of saying, okay, this takes care of the statewide, this is all we really care about, and now we create a process that when we get to the smaller batches, the smaller styles, that we have something that's not workable. And so I'm cautious about just looking at a simplistic approach for the moment.
Thank you, Merlin. And I do understand that. But for the limited time we have in our meetings and even just over the next couple of months, my thought process was to just get something workable. And so it's just not all theoretical. I encourage everybody here and online that listen to this to submit comments regarding even these more intricate matters and thoughts that you have, because we do take it all into consideration and being able to put it in a way that when the rulemaking happens, that we do address these concerns, and that they can be really thought about, so your input is valuable. And also, before we wrap up the discussion about the ballot manifest, if the counties could send me how you create your batches and your how they're organized, that would be helpful to the group, I think, to really see how this is all operated, because how one county does it will be different than how other counties do it. And it's important to understand how this is happening in the counties, because we can't go to every county at the beginning of the election to see how you're processing ballots, how you're organizing ballots. If you can provide a written procedure on how you do that, that would be helpful for us to understanding, okay, do we create the our ballot manifest similar to Douglas County, where they just do it right when ballots come in, or if other counties organize their ballots after their scan. So I think that would be helpful to have that insight into how your operation works, for us to be able to really then say, okay, this is how we should have our ballot manifest, and this is the information that should go into the ballot manifest. I think that would be a good starting point for us to be able to get that information. We only have a few minutes left, and so I wanted we'll conclude. We'll pick up next time on the pre-election and phase, and go through some of these other items. I know I'll receive more comments, and then we'll just keep adding to the list and continue on this path. Just a couple more things before we conclude. The first is you may have seen in our agenda that was posted online that there's a formation of a subgroup to assist with the development and testing of risk limiting audit tool. Along the lines that we were talking about earlier with having an audit center or something similar to that, We do recognize the need for robust software to be able to assist us in conducting the risk limiting audit. And so what we have done is we've reached out to Neil McBurnett in our IT department to start working towards the end of developing these utilities, the software, to be able to assist us in conducting risk limiting audits. I just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention, since it was on our agenda item in our notice for this conference today. And so that's something that we will be working on and taking input from this group into that group, so we can start developing software that we can use and test, especially later this spring and for sure into the throughout the summer. So I just wanted to bring that to our attention. And then the last item, I wanted to just remind everybody that our office, the voting systems team, we have a lot going on, and not to say that nobody else has anything going on, but I'm speaking selfishly from our group, that we do really have a lot on our plate. So it's really imperative that we stick to the 5 p.m. deadline for submitting comments by next Friday, because outside of RLA, I'm looking at a lot of other documentation, and so this is helpful for me to have it first thing Monday morning when I come in, so I can start reading and understanding and trying to understand where everybody's coming from, to be able to formulate it into a summary and for internal use, and then also the stuff we post online. So people, when my management asks me questions about where we're at and the things we're doing, I can be able to respond in a timely manner. So that 5 p.m. deadline next Friday is really crucial. And so I really appreciate if you can get me your comments to me by that time, and I'll try to my best to turn them around to get them posted online for public consumption. And so, Neil, you have a comment before we can...
Well, I was just going to point out that those of us working kind of on volunteer time and over the weekend, did it work this time, just as you were saying, to have it available for you on Monday morning? Is it okay for us to work over the weekend and send it in so that you have it then?
So if you send it on Sunday or something like that, that's fine. But, I mean, it's like, you know, I really can't... take anything, you know, past 9 a.m. on Monday, because
appreciate that.
The inbox just gets flooded, and it's hard for me to be able to keep up with everything. So, I do respect that, because you are volunteering your time. You're not getting paid to be here. But that's just something that I really need at that time.
So this is Harvey. Are you assigning homework this time for for next Monday, or are we just free to comment on what we've been hearing?
Well, the comments I would like to just keep to what's practical, instead of differences of do we look at a ballot or CVR first type discussions of okay, if we can just work off of the outline here of you know, does the comments that were made, like I said, I try to summarize it. Does it make sense? For instance, to talk about defining a batch size. And if it does, what should the batch size be? Should we have a range of from 1 to 100? I know Arapahoe County, for instance, said that they found with their experience having batch sizes of 100 works ideally for them. And so should that be something that we contemplate in putting in the rule of defining a batch size? I mean, I don't know. That's why we need input as to if that makes sense to define that or not. If it doesn't make sense to define it, then we shouldn't. But if there's a case for it, then we should. And I know there will be differences of opinion, but that's stuff that we need to figure out if it's worth going down on discussion on and really diving into in other parts of the process. I can't assign somebody to one task at this point, you know.
I think it was very productive to assign the task last time to come up with steps in the election. So I would actually encourage you to come up with questions like that for us to grind on over the week, in the first week before the 2 weeks we meet again. And perhaps they could be just a list of things that we haven't discussed yet on the agenda there.
Okay. Thank you for the suggestion, Harvey. And that's something I'll work on for the next meeting is this task assignment. I just didn't know how far we would get today, but I just want to start talking about these things and seeing how far we would get. And so for the next meeting, kind of getting a feel for how this conference is going, I'll be able to do that. So with all that being said, I hope everybody has a good weekend. We're going to conclude this meeting today. It's around 3:30 p.m. Mountain Time. I hope everybody has a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.